I'm Julianne Good, and this is Psych 101. Welcome. We are here to make psychology more understandable with tips for you, your family, and your friends to make your lives easier. Tonight, my special in-studio guest is Dr. Claudia Owen Shields, and we are going to be talking about Suicide Prevention Month. This is a very heavy and important topic that we as a society do not talk about enough, and it's very important. So please stay tuned, and I hope you get something out of this, and I hope you get some help if you need it, or if anybody else that you know of is very depressed and suicidal. So stay tuned. So Dr. Owen Shield, welcome. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And can you give the audience a little bit of a background of your clinical experience?
Well, I'm a licensed clinical psychologist in California, and I'm also the chair of the clinical PsyD program at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. And I have some expertise in treating severe and suicidal depression.
Thank you. And my first question for you is, how common is suicide?
It's much more common than people might think. Suicide is among the top 10 causes of death. Most recent estimates from the Centers for Disease Control say that about 41,000 people in a one-year period will commit suicide. So this is equivalent to about one person dying from suicide every 13 minutes.
Oh.
Suicide is even more common than serious public health concerns like homicide and HIV/AIDS. The suicide rate is typically more than double the homicide rate. So where there are about 41,000 suicides, there were 16,121 homicides during that same period.
Mm-hmm. And does it also take into account attempted suicides? Or do you know if there's any statistics on those?
Well, these numbers are specific to completed suicides. Now, obviously, the number of attempted suicides are considerably higher.
Mm-hmm. And is there a variation between the genders? Do men commit suicide more than women, or how does that play out?
Absolutely. In general, the suicide rate is four times higher in men than in women. But this information should be taken with caution because women do commit suicide, just not as often as men do. According to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, 70% of all suicides were committed by white males. The lowest suicide rates were reported to be among African American women. It's also important to note that suicide rates have steadily increased for people between the ages of 45 and 64. And this is a fairly recent development, you know, maybe in the last 8 years. We used to see that as being people over 80. Mm-hmm. And now those numbers are slightly higher than people in their 80s. So we are seeing an increase in that population, in that age group.
Mm-hmm. And is there any information as to why those age groups are deciding to end their lives?
So there are a number of factors that will put a person at risk for suicide. And what seems to be true is depending on where a person is developmentally, they may be at higher risk for those factors. So for instance, if you look at people who are above 80, they're going to be likely to have some of the risk factors like living alone, maybe having an illness, feeling isolated, those kinds of things.
Yeah, definitely one of the huge factors is isolation.
Absolutely.
and going into a depressive state, and especially in that age range. A lot of people lose their lifetime mates, mm-hmm. you know, husband, wife, or a lot of their friends are dying and they're feeling alone, that, you know, their social circle is starting to dwindle.
Absolutely. And most of the time, suicides are committed when people are alone. So if you live alone, if you don't have a significant other, if you don't have people checking in on you, you're going to have more time alone, and that can increase your risk.
Mm-hmm. And do they have any reasonings behind the increase in the 45 to 65 age range?
I'm not sure what the reasoning behind that is. My hunch, so this is not based in statistical research at this point, but my hunch is that I'm looking at the way our society is changing. And people are living longer. So one of the things that that means is that if you're in that age range, two things may be true. You may be part of what we call the sandwich generation. And so that means that two things may be true. You may be caring for children. You may have kids that are in college on the one end. And then on the other end, you may be caring for adults, your parents who are aging. And so, and you may also still be working. Mm-hmm. And so the stress levels and the amount of information that we are required to manage. The other thing is those numbers pretty closely parallel the recession. So this trend changed around 2007. We hit our worst recession right around that time. And so unemployment can also be a factor.
Yeah, that's what I was going to mention too. That's especially when the recession hit and middle management and that age range was being fired first. They were being let go in droves. So because they didn't want to, you know, eventually pay them pension and everything else. So they wanted to hire cheaper, younger workers.
That's a good point.
I had seen some statistics on that too, and I was shocked because, you know, before 2007, it seemed to be, you know, the likely age range, you know, teens, early 20s, you know, not quite knowing what they're doing with their lives and, you know, not quite settled into what am I supposed to do for the rest of my life. So having that uncertainty was always a risk factor.
Absolutely.
So the numbers changing is pretty dramatic.
Absolutely.
So what are some of the factors that go into a person wanting to end their lives because they've had it? Mm-hmm. They're just, you know, at the end of their ropes.
Yeah. So the most common reason that people commit suicide is that they're experiencing what we call a major depressive episode. And so what that means is that the person has at least 2 weeks of having either or both loss of interest or pleasure in almost all activities and or feeling depressed. And by depressed, we're talking about sadness, feeling empty, feeling hopeless. Now, it's important to understand, though, that when we talk about this kind of depression, we're not just talking about sadness. People who are having a major depressive episode will also often have significant changes in appetite and eating. So they may be malnourished, for instance. They may have significant changes in their sleeping patterns. So they may have difficulty sleeping or sleeping almost all the time. They may be feeling agitated or slowed down, having what we call psychomotor retardation, which is a kind of a heavy feeling. It's akin to fatigue, but not quite that. This sort of difficulty moving. I'll sometimes describe it as feeling like you're moving underwater. Mm-hmm. So it's literally hard to get up and move across the room. Coupled with that will also often be exhaustion or low energy nearly every day. Feeling worthless, excessive guilt, difficulty thinking or concentrating. And with this sometimes will come recurrent thoughts of death, thoughts of suicide or suicidal plan. One of the things that's really important to understand is that often when people are experiencing these episodes, they have significant difficulty functioning. So getting up and going to work is now difficult. Now, add to that some of the things you were mentioning earlier, particularly during the recession when people are being laid off, there's more stress about performing. Oh my gosh, if I can't get up and get to work, then I'm worthless. Well, worthlessness is one of the risk factors. That sense of worthlessness is one of the risk factors. And so you start to get kind of a downward spiral. The other thing that's important to understand is that these symptoms are not the result of a substance use or other medical condition. And for some folks, they seem to come out of the blue. You know, you'll hear people say, I've got this great life. Why am I feeling this way?
Right.
And so this can be due to chemical imbalances in the brain. It can be due to fatigue. It can be due to any variety of things that the person may not be aware of that are happening to them, stress over time. And so episodes like these can come on if a person has a major depressive disorder or a bipolar disorder, what sometimes people call we used to call manic depression. So with those two disorders, those two together are the number one cause of suicide. At one point, I read a study that suggested that 85% of suicides were related to the major depressive episodes that can happen in those two disorders.
So it's really important to be able to know the signs and symptoms.
Absolutely.
Of major depression, or even if you get the blues and some sadness, and it goes on for, you said, about 2 weeks.
2 weeks,
consistently.
Right.
To really take note of that and
Absolutely.
To go get some help. And
Absolutely.
If you know somebody that's in that condition, to reach out to them and say, hey, can I do something for you? Can I help in any way?
Absolutely.
And just start getting the ball rolling, because this can be life-threatening.
Absolutely.
If you don't get to the core of this and stop it, because there's so many ways of getting help.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I've often told my students that the major depressive episodes are the most dangerous. They are the most likely to result in lethality. So very important that we get help, and the sooner the better, because one of the things that happens is that the longer a person is depressed, the deeper the depression gets, the longer it tends to last, if that makes sense.
Exactly. Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
So what can a person do if they're starting to have what's called suicidal ideations?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, honestly, probably most of us have had those coming in and out. It's, you know, sometimes you get too stressed out in life and you think, well, it'd be easier if I just ended this. Mm-hmm. I think most people have that kind of a, you know, fleeting thought from time to time. But what changes it from just an ideation to you're actually going to act out upon it?
Mm-hmm. So it's a really important question. One of the things when we're assessing suicide risk is we'll ask a person, for instance, really any time a client comes in to see us clinically, one of the standard questions we'll ask is, do you ever have thoughts of hurting yourself or ending your life? It's kind of a standard question.
Yes.
And often people will say, well, you know, like you just said, well, sometimes I think about it, but I would never actually do it. I will often ask a question, if they don't say that, if they say, well, yes, I have thoughts about it, how often are you having these thoughts? Are these things that you just think about? Do you have a plan? If a person says, yes, I have a plan, then I'm going to ask them, tell me what that plan is as specifically as you can. Tell me exactly what it is you're thinking about doing. And sometimes my students are afraid to ask that question because they think, well, if I ask that, will they be more likely to do it? And actually, the research suggests that the more you ask about it, you're actually reducing the risk. So if they have a plan, and the plan is very detailed, and it's a lethal plan, that's going to suggest that they're at higher risk than someone who says, well, you know, I don't know, I haven't really thought about it. Sometimes I think about, and they give you sort of something sort of vague, as opposed to, yes, I know exactly what I do, I know when I would do it. Then you ask, do you have the means to do it? Right, so you've got this very detailed plan, do you have the means to do it? What are those means? Where are they? Right? And so if a person says, yep, here's my detailed plan, I even know when I'm going to do it, and I have the stuff at home or in my car, then that's when you say, okay, now we've got a 911 kind of emergency,
yes.
Right? And we want to separate that person immediately from the means, whether it's firearm or pills or poison or whatever it is, even if we think it's something that is a lower risk. So we do think in terms of, you know, firearms, 51%, for instance, of suicides happen by firearms. So obviously that's the most lethal. But people, there's still that other 49%, right?
Right.
And so people do die by other means. So we always, always, always take it seriously. Even if a person says, oh, I'm just joking, I still take it seriously.
Yes, I do too.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else should too. And I know sometimes when a person almost nonchalantly says something like that and says, oh, I'm just kidding, teasing, whatever, you still have to look at, is there truth behind that?
Absolutely.
And take that seriously, because I've heard people that I've dealt with doing counseling say, well, this person was joking about committing suicide. I didn't take them seriously because, you know, that's just kind of their mannerisms.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, they committed suicide.
Yes.
And they felt so guilty. They had such a difficult time.
Absolutely.
And that's the whole thing. It's just, you know, the person who commits suicide leaves behind the people.
Yes.
And the guilt and the torture and everything else. It's somebody else's burden now.
Yes.
That people may not ever get over.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things my students will sometimes say is, well, what if I'm wrong? What if they're not really going to do it? What if they were just joking? And I call 911. And so I say, you know, the concern that you have is that you're going to err. And would you rather err on the side of being too cautious? And so you've inconvenienced the person. Maybe you've ruined their night, but you've saved their life.
Exactly.
On the other side, possibly. And so that's an error that I've decided. Now, as professionals, one of the things that we have to concern ourselves with, are we taking the least restrictive level of care? Right, because we don't want to get into violating someone's rights unnecessarily, mm-hmm. right? And so that's something that we have to wrestle with. But I will say, even as a professional, if I'm in doubt and I'm thinking, okay, I might get sued because I acted too zealously on this person's behalf, that's still an error I would rather make. I'm not going to make it lightly. I'm going to take this very seriously and I'm going to be as careful as I can. But again, even if I have to pick which mistake, I'd rather have a person be alive and really angry with me, right, than the alternative.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So everybody listening, if you're in that situation, please, by all means, get help for the person. Call 911, get them to an emergency room, get them help, and just, you know, just take care of the person. Or take care of yourself if you're in that situation also. If you would like to join us in this conversation, you can call in at 800-893-9562. Again, that's 800-893-9562. And we'll be right back after the break.
The Chicago School of Professional Psychology offers numerous psychology, behavioral, and health-related science graduate degrees at three campuses: Los Angeles, California, including branches in Westwood and Irvine, Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C., and online. The Chicago School prepares students to meet the ever-changing mental health needs of society through classroom experience and real-world training. The Chicago School Counseling Centers in Irvine and Westwood provide caring, confidential, and affordable psychological services to individuals and their families. For more information, visit thechicagoschool.edu.
And thank you to the Chicago School of Professional Psychology for sponsoring Psych One-on-One. I'm here this evening with Dr. Claudia Owen Shields, and we are discussing suicide and suicide prevention. So, Dr. Owen Shields, what is the new phase almost on bullying and suicide? It seems to be very prevalent now and a huge concern for especially younger people.
Absolutely, and I'm glad that you raised that question. There is a growing concern that teens or preteens who are bullied are more likely to commit suicide. And we're still gaining some clarity on the exact relationship between bullying and suicide. But according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they're saying that it is correct to say that involvement in bullying with other risk factors increases the chance that a young person will engage in suicide-related behavior. So there does seem to be a relationship. They caution us, though, about suggesting that bullying by itself is a direct and independent cause of suicide. So in other words, if you have an otherwise, sort of perfectly well-adjusted kid, as if there is such a thing, right? And the only thing that happens to them is bullying, mm-hmm. that is unlikely to lead to suicide. But most kids who are bullied do not commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
But what seems to be true is that suicide seems to exacerbate or I'm sorry, bullying seems to exacerbate other risk factors. So if you have somebody who has maybe sort of underlying depression and you bully them, right, then that can make the depression worse and lead them to suicide. And one of the things that's really tricky is to identify depression. Parents have a really tough time sometimes identifying that their kid's depressed for a couple of reasons. We think in our society that depression means I'm crying all the time or I'm sad. In adults, even, it doesn't necessarily mean that. It could mean you just can't experience pleasure.
Mm-hmm, right.
Okay? In kids, sometimes it's irritable. They're just a little irritable, you know. In adolescents, we think, oh, well, they're just being an adolescent, right? And so it you can miss that. And so then parents will think, well, my kid was fine until this bullying started. And they'll think, well, the bullying alone is what caused it. And sometimes there's underlying things that by themselves might not lead to suicide, but when you add that to bullying, it can. And so we're doing a lot of work, and I've done some work with some school districts specifically, looking at suicide prevention and helping kids understand the power that they have when they're bullying. So one of the things, for instance, you'll see, kids that are more likely to be bullied are kids maybe that are new to the school, that don't have a lot of friends. Well, if you don't have a lot of friends, that's a risk factor for suicide, as we've said earlier, mm-hmm. right? And so one of the things we try to help kids understand is if there's a kid that you see on the playground that never has anybody playing with them, one of the things you can do that can both prevent bullying and possibly prevent suicide, be the friend or pretend to be, you know, play with them. Even if this isn't, you know, your favorite person to be with, hang out with them a little bit. Because isolation, particularly in kids in a new environment, can be very damaging to the kids, right? And so, and then if they have people playing with them, they're also less likely to be bullied,
mm-hmm.
right? So a lot of factors to consider.
A little attention goes a long way.
Absolutely.
For anybody.
Absolutely. We are social beings. We really are. And connection is very important for most of us.
Yeah, I mean, even if the people who sit there and say, I don't like other people. I mean, I always find that fascinating when somebody comes up with that excuse. I mean, there's so much power behind a statement like
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I would rather hang out with myself. And, you know, it's just, it's sad. Mm-hmm. And it's just the loneliness of it. And we do need other people. Mm-hmm. That's,
well,
we're wired for it.
There are a minority of folks who really do prefer solitude, who prefer their own company, and who are just fine with that. But that doesn't seem to be the norm. And I think it's important for individuals who say they prefer solitude to check it out. You know, do I really? And if I do, that's great. If this is something I'm sort of telling myself and I'm really lonely and maybe I don't feel like I have the social skills to connect, then that's something that maybe you can get some help with,
mm-hmm.
right? There are folks that can help you learn to reach out if that's what you need. So I think it's really about knowing yourself.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's one thing that we're deficit on nowadays is social skills. We're becoming so much more technologically dependent every day mm-hmm. that we start losing focus on other people. We get into our our computer screens and cell phones and such, and we start losing how to talk with another person.
That's a good point. You know, even when we're thinking about bullying, cyberbullying is really lethal. And people seem to be a little bit more willing to engage in mean behavior when they feel a little bit more anonymous. You know, they're sort of hiding behind the screen, if you will. And so they'll say things in cyberspace that they might not say face-to-face. And then multiply that by the number of people who are going to see that. And so we really get concerned when we see that there are cases or instances of cyberbullying.
So what would you do in a case of cyberbullying? If it was your child that was the target of that, how do you mitigate mm-hmm. that kind of damage?
Yeah. So first of all, hopefully, if that were to happen, my child, I have a 12-year-old daughter, that she would share it with me. Mm-hmm. And my sense is that she would, because I usually hear about when things happen at school, but that she would share it with me. And then my first thought would be to make sure that she understands that this is not about her, that people do and say mean things, and that she understands who she is. The other thing is that I think as an act of prevention, we can kind of create a buffer for our kids. So we should expect that our kids are going to go through the world, and not everyone is going to be nice to them all the time. It's a painful thing as a parent to think about, mm-hmm. sometimes unimaginable, right? And so if we're constantly loading them, preloading them, if you will, with positive messages about how amazing they are, praising them, as the behaviors would say, catch them doing something right. Mm-hmm. So every time they do something, love how you did that. So that when those attacks come, and they will, right, there's a buffer. They already have a good sense of themselves, and they're more likely to come to you because they know that you're probably going to give them more of that, mm-hmm. right? So I think that's sort of on the front end. The other thing is sometimes it can be tough to address if you can find out who the author of it is. Often they're people they've met at school. I would absolutely alert the teachers. Teachers often are not aware of it, and parents will often assume that the teachers know. When we think about student-teacher ratios,
there's right? no way.
Gosh, and then the amount of information yeah. that the teacher has on each student. So don't assume that the teacher knows. Let the teacher know about it. Don't hesitate to talk to principal, counselor, mm-hmm. everyone else. You might even, you know, offer to be a resource to the school. You know, how about we do a PTA meeting on bullying, and I'll, you know, find the speaker, right? And I've done this with schools, getting kids to work together to come up with solutions. Kids are really the best resource because they're on the ground, if you will. They're mm-hmm. the ones who see it, who know what's happening. They know a lot more about it than the adults do. And you'd be amazed at how good they are at coming up with solutions for it.
Mm-hmm. And peer support is
Absolutely.
Really important. That's
great. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
I think, too, I've worked with several clients who have been in that position of being victimized by bullying. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and if they had self-esteem issues on top of it, it makes it very difficult to get it through to them that, you know, usually people who do bullying are very insecure on the inside mm-hmm. and they're very sad and mad and they're possibly mm-hmm. being abused at mm-hmm. home. So kind of getting that understanding going with them so they know a little bit better. It's not them for the most part. It's the other person's problem and they're projecting it out.
And we have along those lines what we call bully perpetrators. So people who have been, perpetrator victims, rather people who've been bullied and are bullies. And often they bully because it's happened to them. Maybe in another setting, maybe at a school where they came from, maybe they're happening simultaneously, maybe it's happening at home.
Yeah, so it's getting to them again. It's finding the red flags,
right,
and trying to get that intervention going.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I was just about to sneeze, so I had to take a moment here. William, my board op is laughing at me. Thank you, William. I had to break it up a little bit. So now going back to adults mm-hmm. and trying to sift through the problems that may occur before, you know, the suicidal ideation hits. Do you have any like signs that you can see?
Absolutely. Well, yeah. So a couple things to think about. So one is the depressive episodes that we talked about, and like we mentioned earlier, you can see some of those signs. Sometimes it'll be something really obvious, almost too obvious. Like, you know, you're taking an exam and you think, okay, this can't be the right answer. It's too easy. So sometimes a person talking about wanting to die, right? And we don't take it seriously. But sometimes that's often, you know, sort of the number one thing that points to it. And so the other one is this sense of hopelessness. Aaron Beck used to say that if you could predict hopelessness, that he believed that was the number one predictor of suicide. There's no hope for me. My life's not going to get any better. And often the way that we push through crises is we say, okay, I just have to ride this out. Things are going to get better. This too shall pass. Mm-hmm. But when you find that people can't do that, which sometimes happens in depression, one of the things that can happen in depression is a person can feel like, not only will I always feel this way, I've always felt this way. They almost lose the ability to see that there was a time when they felt good. It's almost like the depressed part of themselves doesn't know the non-depressed part, mm-hmm. particularly if they've been depressed for a really long time. So when I start to hear that, but any extreme change, like in sleeping, and a lot of times it'll start there. A person will show up, I can't sleep. So that could be that depression is on its way. It could also be the thing that ushers it in, right? So sleep deprivation is linked to a whole host of things. So I might say to the person, when's the last time you had a physical? Because sometimes something physiological is going on. Mm-hmm. I also want to know about their substance use. Alcohol and drugs are implicated in about 1/3 of cases of suicide. So if a person is a substance user, or if they're drinking heavily, that is a risk factor. And then there's, all the things we mentioned before. You know, what's their sex? Do they live alone? Another big one is prior history. Mm-hmm. So once a person's made an attempt, their risk goes up significantly. So if this person is prior history. So I remember a situation once where I was working at an agency, and we had a gentleman call in, and he was a white male, recently retired, close to 70, had a firearm, was living alone, had just lost his spouse, right? And you can just, all of the risk factors are mounting. And so that's someone that I would say is absolutely at high risk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Does that get at kind of what you're asking?
Definitely, yeah. Because I think it's important for people to understand what the risk factors are so that they can, go in and try to prevent suicide.
Absolutely.
Their own or somebody else's, because as I had mentioned, and I always, do this on all of my shows, if you get to a certain point and things do not change and you're getting into that helpless and hopeless mode, do action and go and get the help. And that's okay, because so many people go through this. So many people go through, the blues stage and difficulties, and life is really complex and complicated now.
Absolutely.
But absolutely, there's so many avenues to getting help.
Absolutely.
So can you mention what the National Suicide Hotline number is?
Yes, absolutely. There's a U.S. National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and that's 1-800-273-TALK, 1-800-273-TALK, or 8255. Also, most areas have local suicide prevention hotlines. You can literally go into Google, put in suicide prevention hotline, your zip code, your area code, and you're going to get the suicide prevention lines that pop up. Some things you can also do, if you can't remember to do that, pick up the phone and dial 911. Call a trusted friend. Get to a mental health professional. Mm-hmm. Some of that's going to depend on how urgent it is. So as you were saying earlier, sometimes it sort of starts off sort of slowly and the person's just sort of feeling blue all the time. That's the time to start making those appointments, making that appointment for a physical, maybe seeing a psychologist or psychiatrist, marriage and family therapy, or a social worker, someone that you can talk to, and someone that can help monitor you and sort of check in with you regularly to see how you're doing. Are you becoming suicidal? Are those vague thoughts turning into plans, right? Are those plans turning into now you're starting to engage in behaviors? So you definitely, the more people you can surround yourself with, the better. And one of the things that I think is so problematic about the myth of suicide being rare, right? And that's perpetuated because we hear about homicides nightly on the news.
Right.
We rarely hear about suicide. Is that people think, well, it must just be me. Right? I'm alone in this. And I really want people to understand that, you know, this is very prevalent. And the numbers that I mentioned earlier are just the numbers of completed attempts. So hundreds of thousands of people think about it. And so I want people to know you're not alone, and you'd be surprised when you reach out to someone. They might often say, you know what, I understand, it's happened to me too. And even if they don't, that's okay. If they love you and respect you, they will listen to your experience and hopefully be invested enough just to say, okay, this is real for you, let's get you some help. So one of the things to think about, and I encourage people to do this whether they're suicidal or not, I think it's really important in life to always think, who are my people? Who are my support? Who are the folks that I can go to? Because if you don't have that, you're at risk for a lot of things, right? So you want to make sure you have your village surrounding you, people who know you. I sometimes jokingly say to my students when doing certain exercises with them, you know, if you did something really bad, right, who would be the person you'd call and tell about it, mm-hmm. right? And they sort of giggle, right? Who's the person that you trust, you know, with your deepest secrets? Have a person like that in your life. Reach out to them, and you may be surprised at how good they are at providing you support. If nothing else, maybe they're the one that pick up the phone, mm-hmm. right, and dial 911 or escort you to the emergency room.
Right. So, and if you're not fortunate to have that type of person in your life, at least call the suicide prevention line, because they are trained professionals. You can call up anonymously.
Absolutely.
And just say, this is what I'm feeling like right now. It's good to have another person on the other end of the line listening to you.
Absolutely. They can be wonderful. The
yes.
calls are free, right? And they will talk to you and get you help.
Yes. Thank you. If you would like to join us in this conversation on suicide prevention, the number is 800-893-9562. It's 800-893-9562. We are going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with Psych 1-on-1.
Are you searching for answers and insight to life issues? Is the behavior of family or friends questionable or concerning? Find tips and possible solutions from the convenience of your own PC, cell phone, or tablet at therapycable.com. Therapy Cable has the most comprehensive library of contemporary therapy videos online. Help may be as easy as a few clicks away. Therapy Cable offers comprehensive therapy videos ranging from addiction to self-care and contact information for qualified providers. Find the answers to your life challenges at therapycable.com.
We'll be right back.
to Psych One-on-One with Julianne Good and Dr. Claudia Owen Shields, and we are talking about suicide prevention. September is Suicide Prevention Month, and Dr. Owen Shields, are there any particular groups of people who are more likely to commit suicide than others?
So yes, I'm glad you brought us back to that question. We did talk a little bit about groups of adults previously, but what I didn't get to were looking at teens. And so one of the leading causes of death among teens is suicide. And according to the American Association of Suicidology, roughly 4,600 youth between the ages of 15 and 24 died by suicide in the United States in 2010. In addition to these deaths, every year roughly 157,000 youth receive emergency medical treatment for injuries that are self-inflicted. And you had asked earlier about suicide attempts, and so we're seeing quite a number of those among youth. In a national survey of 9th to 12th graders, 15.8% reported that they had seriously considered suicide during the past year. 12.8% reported planning an attempt. 7.8% reported making an attempt. And 2.4% reported that they required immediate medical attention as a result. And of these ninth graders, of the 9th to 12th graders, significantly more Hispanic female students, so 13.5%, reported attempting suicide than non-Hispanic Black or white students. And again, this is according to the Centers for Disease Control. And I think, you know, we're in Los Angeles where there are large Latino populations. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important to be aware of, especially here.
Right, because I think too, maybe societally, they're more apt to not discuss wanting to commit suicide. It's, you know, the wanting to hide it a little bit more just because of so many cultural pressures that, you know, at least the Hispanic population I've worked with find it very difficult to come forward for help outside of the family unit.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so often what happens with many Latino populations, and I don't want to say all by any means, is that if a Latino person comes in for therapy, often the family comes with them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
And so anything that is shared clinically with a psychologist, for example, might also be shared with the family. I can remember early in my work always having to sort of scramble for extra chairs. Mm-hmm. And so the other thing is that there's sometimes a sense that if one family member is sick, the entire family member is sick. And so I think that's a really powerful supportive way. But I think sometimes the person feels like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be such a burden to my family. I don't want to do this to my family. Right. And so, and then sometimes if they're religious, they may think, well, I'm having sinful thoughts, right? It's a sin to kill yourself. So I can't tell anybody that I'm having these evil thoughts. And then when you couple that to the sense of worthlessness and guilt that often accompanies depression, then that can actually make it worse. So we do have a lot of people suffering in silence. Again, I come back to those statistics. Twice as many people are dying from suicide than homicide. And they're dying silently. It's one of our nation's greatest secrets.
It is. And it's so full of, you know, shame within the person that's committing suicide, within the, you know, society around them, neighbors, friends, mm-hmm. family members. And again, it's suffering in silence.
Absolutely.
And it can be prevented.
Absolutely. One of the other things I want to mention is that sometimes I'll hear people say, well, gosh, how selfish of them to do that to their family. Or, gosh, that's a coward's way out. I will hear this said sometimes after people have completed suicide attempts. And I want to say this, that unless you have experienced what it's like to suffer from a clinical major depressive disorder or episode, right, or some of the other things that come together often with those things that contribute to that absolute desperation, it's really hard to understand what it's like to go through. And so what often people think is, you know, you'll hear people say, well, I was just with them 2 days ago and they seemed fine, mm-hmm. right? Well, they looked fine. They seemed fine. And people are very good often at hiding this. So then we think, well, why would a person in their quote unquote right mind do this? I don't understand. I'm angry. There's often a lot of anger and rage at the person if they've made an attempt and when they've completed an attempt and they're no longer with us. There's still a lot of anger. How could they do this to us? It's really important to understand that often what goes with that is a sense of worthlessness, and the person literally believes that their family and friends would actually be better off without them. And that's part of the illness that accompanies this. So the person can seem fine, maybe a little down, but fine, right? And they're really not. And so I think that contrast between the person looking okay and how severely they're suffering is very confusing to people. With that, I want to say that if there's anyone who's listening who has lost a loved one, there is a contagion factor. If you've lost a loved one to suicide, that can also increase risk. And we're not sure why that is, but one theory is that now that person is, they are possibly alone. That's a risk factor. They may also be feeling guilt. So if you are feeling guilt, if you're thinking, I should have done, it's going to be really important that you get help with those feelings and you find a way to let that go. That's not going to help you and it doesn't help the other person. And I can't stress that enough.
Exactly. And it comes down to the point that the person who committed suicide, that was their ultimate decision.
That was their ultimate decision.
To do that. And I have to mention also, the Robin Williams
Absolutely.
Situation should have been a real wake-up mm-hmm. for the world on suicide. And why did, I mean, there were so many rumors as to why he did it and stuff, mm-hmm. but he was going to, you know, have Parkinson's. Mm. And he started having the beginning stages of it, mm-hmm. and he just didn't want to go through the suffering,
Absolutely.
And that was it. But I thought it was great, though, that at least the information was coming out and people were talking about
Absolutely.
It and the facts were coming out then, so people could actually bring this to the table and talk about this openly, because he was a beloved person.
And
most people really enjoyed Robin Williams, and everybody was in shock
yes.
when they heard the story.
Absolutely. Well, I had read many years ago, and I can't remember where I read this, was that he did suffer from bipolar disorder. And I don't
right.
know if that's true, but I had read that.
Yes, I
and
read that too.
And a large number, one of the greatest risk factors, as I said earlier, is having a bipolar disorder, particularly when you're on the depressive cycle, or the depressive end of that cycle, that a significant number of people with that become suicidal.
Right. And then he had been a previous cocaine abuser mm-hmm. and who knows what other drugs. Again,
right.
it's the self-medication.
Absolutely.
So they seem to go hand in hand, you know, the
Absolutely.
Substance abuse, the
Absolutely.
Drinking, the, you know, I'm trying to look like I'm normal so that I can get through my day. People don't suspect what's really going on inside of me and all the turmoil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So as we are wrapping up, what tips can you give people if they are in this situation or they know somebody mm-hmm. who is displaying these signs yeah. and symptoms?
Yeah. So first, if someone's listening and they are feeling any of these things, the first thing I'll say is be really kind to yourself. Forgive yourself. It's not your fault.
Yes.
This is not a character defect. This is an illness. It's not a weakness. And from that place of kindness, then seek help. As we were saying earlier, call that trusted friend. See a licensed professional. Call 911 if you need to. Go to an emergency room. Walk into a clinic. Call your doctor, right? Any of these folks, that they'll know how to help you get help. And to allow yourself to heal. Give yourself time. In the same way if you're feeling really awful physically, right, you might say, you know, I'm just too sick to expect myself to do the things I would normally do. Often people don't give themselves that grace. They think, oh, it's just in my head, right? Well, if you're not able to function because of this, it's not just in your head. This is a real illness. And so being kind to yourself, giving yourself plenty of time to heal, just like you would with anything else. There's still such a stigma around emotional and mental disorders. And we internalize that stigma. And we think that we can have an emotional illness and still expect ourselves to function the way we normally do. And that's so unkind. So be kind to yourself. And if this is happening to someone that you know, be kind to them, encourage them. And also understand that this is probably not something that you're going to be able to sort of help the person cheer up and get over. It's an illness. Like, so taking them to a funny movie and telling them the jokes might just be irritating because they're finding, gosh, here's something else I can't enjoy, right? And so sometimes just sitting with a person, holding their hand while they cry, and you think, well, I don't know what to say. That's okay. Just be there in silence with them and support. If you think that the person is suicidal, it's really important not to leave them alone. Because again, being alone is a risk factor. Most people who commit to suicide have completed attempts when they are alone. Mm-hmm. Again, get them help. All of the same things that you might do for yourself. Can we call your doctor? Is there a family member we can call? Is there someone you trust? And if they say no, then now you're that person.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then can you give that number for the National Suicide Hotline again, please?
Absolutely. That number is 1-800-273-TALK, 1-800-273-TALK, or 8255, 273-8255.
Great, thank you. And if any of our listeners want to contact you, how can they do so?
You can absolutely reach me at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. My email there is cshields@thechicagoschool.edu, cshields@thechicagoschool.edu. And my phone number there is area code 213-615-7273, 615-7273. And do feel free to reach out to me.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Claudia Owen Shields. It was very informative. I'm sure you've helped a lot of people this evening, so thank you.
Thank you for having me, Julia Ann.
And if you'd like to contact me, my email address is jgoode8@verizon.net. My office number is 562-234-4650. I would like to thank my board operator, William Ibarra. Thank you very much. And our executive producer, Jeremy Hansen at Skid Row Studios. And thank you so much for joining me again on Psych 1-on-1. And if you are having suicidal ideations or plans, please, please go get help. There's so much help out there. Reach out and save your life or save a loved one's life. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye now.
Listen to Skid Row.